A quick announcement about episode 8 and the way it's going to be published. Because we spent so much time talking about Bernard and had really enjoyable discussions, the episode is far too long to be presented in our traditional format, where we have part 1 during 1 week and part 2 during the other week. So instead we're going to present it in 4 parts, where during 1 week we're going to put up parts 1 and 2 of the discussion, and during the following week parts 3 and 4. Now, for those listeners who may wish to follow the discussion as it happened and immerse themselves further, we are going to leave a longer recording on the episode page. So go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and click on episode 8, and then you will see the about 2-hour recording for each of the weeks. So one recording will comprise of parts 1 and 2, and the following week of another recording of parts 3 and 4. All right, enjoy the episode. Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is episode 8, still on the functions of the executive by Chester Bernard. In this episode, we finish what we've started in episode 7 by discussing parts 3 and 4 of the book. While you may be perfectly okay listening to this episode on its own, it may be worth to go back and listen to episode 7 if you haven't yet. This way you'll get full benefit from the entire breadth of knowledge about Chester Bernard and the functions he thinks executives should have. This episode is brought to you with the kind support of the Innovation, Knowledge and Organizational Networks Research Center at the University of Warwick. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
And my name is Miranda, coming to you from Leamington Spa in the United Kingdom.
My name is Ralph. I'm coming to you from Melbourne, Australia.
You seem uncertain there, Ralph.
Well, I've been calling it Sydney several times, so I was going very slowly to make sure I got Melbourne right. And plus, that's the Australian pronunciation, because in the United States, we would say Melbourne, and nobody says that here.
It's Melbourne, isn't it?
Yes, Melbourne. And I was reminded yesterday, I'm the guy that's got the cute accent here, not the Australians.
Aww. Yes.
All right. So welcome to episode 8. Pedro is still not with us, but it's not because he doesn't like Bernard or to read long texts, but rather because he's in the process of moving to New York. In fact, last I spoke with him, he was looking for a place to live, which was a bit perplexing since he's already there. So I guess I see how not having a place may impede recording a podcast, but I'm sure he will return for episode 9. Anyway, functions of the executive by Bernard, parts 3 and 4. We're not going to give a lengthy intro this time, as we have done so in episode 7.
Right. The purpose of the book is to provide a comprehensive theory of cooperative behavior. And Bernard considered that fundamental to how organizations function and their longevity. He basically summarized the functions of the executive as follows. It's establishing and maintaining a system of communication, securing essential services from other members, formulating organizational purposes and objectives. And then he talks about great deal about incentives, and that's something we're going to talk about today. And they take four, Bernard's put them in four categories: money and other material inducements, personal non-material opportunities for distinction, desirable physical conditions of work, and ideal benefactions, such as pride of workmanship, and etc. So the second half of the book details the elements of formal organizations, their executive functions, and the place of the executive functions in the survival of cooperation, which Bernard considered worthy of expounding on in considerable length. One of the first key ideas I saw in part 3 is that Bernard talks about the role of specialization in cooperation. And in fact, cooperation cannot be accomplished without specialization, which I thought was an interesting insight that, in fact, that the specialization in an organization sustains the cooperation.
I found that part really interesting. He goes on to talk about specialization not just in the traditional way, in terms of process and, you know, how we're normally used to using this word, but he talks about spatial and temporal specialization, which I could not stop marveling at. It's such a good chapter there. So I don't know about you, but I don't normally think of specialization in terms of where it's happening and at what time, but the way he puts the point across is extremely compelling. The spatial specialization has to do with where work is done, and possibly not as pertinent nowadays, but certainly entirely so at the time that Barnard was writing, that he makes an argument that work, any work, is done somewhere. So you specialize by the place where something is produced or some service is delivered, and there really can't be a situation where one and the same thing is produced in more than one location.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because usually people think of specialization in terms of just particular skills. And so this was a whole different way to look at it from a point of view of location and time, you know, when work is done. In fact, you know, I think that's one of the features of modern work, is that a lot of it is done in, you know, at different times. That's what's interesting about the web and asynchronous forms of communication, which was not commonplace in Barnard's time, which goes to show that this theory he's putting together was general enough it can encompass the kind of work that we see today.
I also found quite interesting within the discussion on specialization, the importance given to the people with who you work, which maybe wasn't that novel. Like, it's an idea that is pretty intuitive, but it's something that I have actually never come across specified in this way in the literature. So I found it quite fascinating.
You know, when you talk about the individuals, which I also thought was very interesting, he makes a comment on page 137 that individuals can lack complete understanding of the general purpose of the organization as long as the members of the unit understand their own objective, right? So this goes back to Miranda's point, where he's focusing on individuals and the work they do. They really have to understand what the objective is of their group or their unit. I'm not sure I completely agree with the idea of the you know, you can lack complete understanding, but maybe that was for the work of his time when it wasn't complicated and as highly integrated as it is today. So that we could talk about that later. But I think that was interesting, where he is saying people have to understand the work that they're doing, and it's fundamental to the way they cooperate.
I will actually read that passage. It's so he says
you should.
That,
it's good. Yeah.
Yes. Since every unit organization in a complex organization is a specialization, so that's clear. The general purpose of the complex must be broken into specific purposes for each unit of organization. Since purpose is the unifying element of formal organization, it is this detailed purpose at the unit level that is effective in maintaining the unit. So let's translate that, maybe. And it pretty much goes down to what you said, that he doesn't believe that. Because when I read this initially, I thought, ooh, unitarism. Everyone has to go in the same direction. But no, just at the unit level. And the reason this is so is because if, in Barnard's opinion, if there isn't lack of unity within a unit, the unit cannot function as a cooperative system and it falls apart. However, it's perfectly fine for him that individual units may not subscribe or understand or perhaps even know about the goal of the entire organization.
So part of that, I think, flows from this idea of the mass production mindset, right? You just take anything really complicated, break it down into tiny parts, and then you kind of reassemble it. And there's a strong neo-positive or positivist approach to that. And I think it depends on the nature of the work. So you know, when we go back and talk about Fayol or Taylor, and we talk about the nature of the really basic industrial work that they were doing, a lot of their theories apply for that kind of work, but get stretched a bit thin theoretically when you look at more complicated kinds of work. Because one of the things I was thinking about when I was reading about this is the Toyota production system actually depends on people in one cooperative unit knowing you know, getting from the prior unit what they need, and so the prior unit has to understand what the next unit needs, and actually integrate their work together. And so, I'm not sure that what Bernard says precludes that. It's just the way he states it. Very emphatically, like a lot of the comments that he makes. I think it may get my expression for it is get stretched thin. It may not be quite so applicable. There's a famous story that Dr. Richard Feynman told in one of his books about the working on the Manhattan Project, and they had people in a room doing calculations on early versions, an early computer, and they were doing punch cards to do calculations for the weapon, and the morale of the unit was very low. You know, because the people who were running the unit said, they weren't going to tell them anything about what they were doing, and so it was drudgery doing all this work on the punch cards. And you know, you make one small error on the punch card, and you have to throw it out and start over. And so their efficiency was very low, their morale was very low. And Feynman got permission to tell them why what they were doing was important and how it fit into the overall structure. And they changed all around. Their morale improved completely. Their efficiency got better. And they actually started suggesting improvements in the process that would make the work go faster. So I recognize that the plural of anecdote is not data, but there is an example, and I've seen many others, where it makes a difference if people understand the bigger picture as well.
I think I read it a bit differently, what he says, because when he says the purpose of the unit, to me that included all what you said. So purpose includes what the unit is working towards, but it might not necessarily include the big picture. So in the case of the atomic bomb, the macro picture wasn't to build it. It was to use it as a means to an end, and that wasn't necessarily shared across the Manhattan Project team, was it?
No, it was not. And you may be right. I may be taking too narrow a reading. I was just looking at the part where he wrote, individual units can lack complete understanding of the general purpose of the organization, right? So you could probably look at, you know, complete understanding and general purpose and interpret those kind of different ways. I guess my concern was that you can't interpret that too narrowly, and you have to take kind of a broader view of it, and then I think it's okay, which I think is what you're doing, which I think is perfectly fine.
Yeah, I think it's just a semantic difference. And later on, he says that it's actually unlikely that within organizations, individual units ever have a understanding of the general purpose. But this is very, very reminiscent of Fayol, because when in this situation, when someone says general purpose, they don't mean the sum of all individual purposes, you know, of each unit that kind of go towards some end goal. What he really means practically is the strategy of the executive team. So the general purpose, I'm reading here in a more critical way, kind of where the executive team is going. So it's not quite accurate in terms of how he puts it, because if you say general purpose as that purpose which unifies the entire organization, then such a thing does not exist normally. At least I can't pick one. But if you think of it as ambitions and desires of the shareholders and the board and the executives, then it's a different situation altogether. Individual purposes of individual units may or may not even be in agreement with the competitive strategy of the organization. That makes sense.
I think it does, and I think the better organizations that have better organizational or better performance and better morale, you know, you tend to see better understanding of the general purpose. But it varies. So you can read that multiple ways, and I think your interpretation is perfectly valid.
Right. I think I want to take a step back a little bit and highlight why he's talking about individual units and not individuals, for instance. I think it's worth reminding that for Bernard, there are no individuals in the organizations. The episode 7 was entitled Phases of Cooperation for a reason, and it is precisely this reason that once Kind of the way organization emerges is that you have individuals who are persons with interests and needs and free will and such, and once they all decide to cooperate, they form an organization which is no longer personal. So the purposes, strategies, goals, and things like objectives replace interests and free will and all that kind of stuff. So this is why units for Barnard are the basic building block of any organization, and this is why he's extensively using this term throughout the book to denote people working together, I think. And part of that is that the constituents of these units, they rely on things like free will, cooperation, communication authority, and all the sort of things that he's talking about in parts 3 and 4 of the book, and which we'll be discussing in due course. And in this chapter, where he is talking about the purpose, he also mentions a bit on free will, I think, unless my notes are in disarray.
Well, I don't know if it's in this chapter. I can't remember if it's in this chapter for sure, but he does cover it in this part for sure. And so we will definitely want to get into
that. Yeah, I think it's in the next chapter, in the economy of incentives. You're right. But yes, yeah, so yes. Chapter 10 is mainly concerned with these matters of purpose and something like why total understanding of work and purposes is not even necessary. In fact, the final sentence of the chapter is understanding, in inverted commas, by itself is rather a paralyzing and divisive element. So there you go.
It's sort of an interesting view. I would say I'm sort of a man of his time. There's certainly practical reasons for that, but it's a very strong statement.
I found it quite sad. I don't know. I don't like this part of it.
Well, explain a little more. Why?
Well, I don't know. I already struggle with this idea of Bernard's work where human beings aren't human beings. Like, it's all cogs within a system. So there's this kind of like idea that if you sort things out, everything will flow consequently. And, well, as I see reality, it doesn't really work like that. And people are curious to know. And if they know, they work even better. And understanding is crucial. I mean, it's the heart of development at the end of the day.
Well, I'm like you. I really strongly resonated about this idea that people don't have to know the complete understanding of the general purpose. I'm a little more settled now that Demetrius said there's different ways, you know, he demonstrated or illustrated there's different ways you could take that. But I was a little less enthused by this chapter or some of the stuff that comes later. But he is setting up some important ideas about specialization and the innovations of specialization. Yeah, it is. And he's setting up some important issues about innovations in specialization and the purposes of the organization. So, okay. I mean, I basically, I think that's kind of what he's... And then there's this... Because he's inventing his own theory of organizations, like some of the other readers, you know, or writers that we've read, he just makes these statements, right? That, you know, traditionally associate with scholarship now, that I find a little difficult to process, but he's largely running from his experience. So I said, okay, so I'll just have to keep going and see where he's going with this.
Also, because like if you remember, maybe I'm skipping a couple of chapters, but I think in the economy of incentives, when it talks about gathering people together and comparing the organization to like a religious organization, this idea of persuasion, but it's a persuasion which isn't, if you relate it to this paragraph in this chapter, it's a persuasion which doesn't relate to the idea of developing understanding or communicating a better understanding. It's just persuasion for the sake of persuasion.
Well, not purely for the sake of persuasion, but because he's talking about how you balance incentives, right? But I agree with you, it would have been better if he related that purpose, talking about the purposes and how they relate to persuasion, because that's we have a lot of scholarship today that says that is a strong factor in incentives. The people, the better people understand the purpose of the organization, or the better it connects to things that they find important, that the more motivated and productive they are. And Bernard is hinting at some of those kinds of things, but I agree with you that I don't feel like he connected those well enough when he's talking about the economy and incentives. But I did think, I thought it was really interesting that he makes a statement that people contribute their efforts because of incentives. Now we're in chapter 11, and he makes this statement, which I thought was very interesting, kind of maybe the darker view. He says that self-preservation and self-satisfaction, basically focus on the self, are the dominant individual motivations or motives unless they can be supplanted with something else, right? So Bernard is suggesting that people are all inwardly focused, and therefore you have to give them something else to believe in, or something else to inspire them. And so I thought that was kind of interesting that when we're talking about incentives, that there's this idea that you have to supplant individual motives that are, you know, kind of strong for people.
Wait, can we go back to chapter 10 still?
Absolutely.
Because there's a few terms that are being thrown around. So we're talking about understanding, about purpose, and about cause. So in terms of understanding, it's important to remember that the way he writes this text is—it's almost a theological text. You recall in episode 7, Miranda brought up a point that he called people energies and that sort of thing. So I think for him, understanding—it is an intellectual process. He says that at the end of chapter 10. So it's an analytical, scholarly sort of acquisition. That is not what he wants people in the organization to have throughout, and that is what he thinks is impossible. So if you think about it, it makes sense. If you're running a large company, you do not expect every single employee, or at least every single unit, to have detailed understanding, analytical understanding of the strategies and techniques involved, not least because it's a waste of their intellectual capabilities, but also, you know, for competitive reasons. You don't want your long-term strategy to just be discussed by the water cooler somewhere. So what he advocates instead is belief in the cause. So I think what the gist of this whole understanding business is, to put in words of Saint Augustine, believe in order to understand. So first and foremost, he wants people to subscribe to an idea of the purpose. So, for instance, I don't know, make awesome cars. That's not the specific outline of how it is to be done and what are the technologies that would go in that, or, you know, that sort of thing. That would be understanding. But the belief in the purpose of producing a quality product that is different and somehow contributes to wider development of the human race, or something else, that's something that, yes, each unit may subscribe to and advocate and incorporate into their activities.
Yeah, and he talks about that later, and we'll have some comments about the role that he thinks believes faith plays. So I agree, there is sort of I don't think you have to say religious when you talk about faith purely, but it's like you said, subscribing to the purpose of the organization. That's very important for sustaining. Remember, he's talking about sustaining the cooperation of the organization. So yeah, he does stress that. But that's coming. I mean, I think you have to read through part 3 and then see how it all fits together. It's not, I don't think it's obvious when you're reading chapter 10 that that's quite where he's going.
Yeah, I just wanted to contest the your dismissal of this bit of information. So we can go back to chapter 11 now.
And that's fine. I didn't intend to dismiss it. I think your interpretation is certainly acceptable, and possible. I just thought he had a dark, the words he used were kind of dark in chapter 11, but it does get better. I completely agree.
I was still talking about chapter 10.
In chapter 10 too, it applies to both.
All right. So chapter 11, the point on this whole Darwinian understanding of human beings, that it's they're gonna they're gonna default to their caveman status unless there's something else to give. Yeah, I thought that was very curious as well.
But not in a negative sort of way, right? I mean, he talks about, okay, so given the, you know, these facts about humans that he takes as self-evident, apparently. You know, how do you use that in organizations to sustain cooperation? So I just thought it was interesting. I'm not getting too concerned about whether that's dark or not. I thought what's really interesting is the implication of the ideas about why it's important to supplant these individual motives. And notice there's on page 144, there's what I would consider sort of a direct challenge to Taylorism or some aspects of Taylorism. Where he says material incentives are so weak as to be almost negligible unless reinforced by other incentives. And in my notes, I basically added, I think he's really talking about commercial, you know, purely commercial organizations, because when you get into faith-based organizations, the material incentives are actually very low in those kinds of organizations. So many charities and educational organizations, you know, people are not sustain their cooperation because of the material incentives. But I thought this was interesting is that I think he's talking about commercial organizations, and maybe any in general, but still almost negligible unless reinforced by other incentives. I mean, that is very, very powerful.
Well, I think he's looking to infuse commercial organizations with this aspect of followership based on non-material incentives that spiritual organizations have.
Yeah, and that's what his experience is. But, you know, just think about that, right? So we're talking a guy who's writing in the 20s and 30s, or, you know, getting his experience, and he's saying, you know, it's not about the pay, right? It's not about just, you know, giving everybody, you know, paying far in excess of what their peers are getting, and they'll just be happy coming to work every day. He said, he used the word almost negligible. Wow, that is really important. I mean, that's very close to the common understanding that we have. Back in our episode on Maslow, right? We said that pay only becomes an incentive up to a certain level, and then it really is not further motivating. So I think that was, so here's a guy writing in the 20s and 30s. He's not saying that directly, but he's basically just saying material incentives, and he acknowledges that pay is, or, you know, remuneration is one of them. So I just thought that was profound for the time.
Definitely. This is one of the things why I love this reading, and why I, having read this, have a newfound deep appreciation of Bernard, and think that everyone, given lots of free time, should read this. But I mean, basically, I think here's why. Not to read this part, but why he's trying to infuse commercial organizations that Taylor and even Fayol saw as little more than rational organizations of processes, really. So chapter 11, The Economy of Incentives, is basically a chapter about why people are willing to cooperate. Do you agree?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So and
how to get them to cooperate.
Okay. I'm going to go with the willing to cooperate bit first.
Okay. Go ahead.
Don't be so fussy, but go ahead.
Sorry.
My entire argument depends
on this. Oh, you just pulled apart his argument. Sorry,
yes.
Sorry.
No, I mean, it's a valid perspective. So, of course, we can look at it as employee-centric and go with my awesome thing, or we can...
Let's go with your
awesome. Yeah, come on, share your awesome thing with
how
us.
How to get people to cooperate and to do the thing Miranda said that we've talked about for like four different episodes already, so...
Go ahead.
Okay, so willingness to contribute to the organization, and the willingness bit, it implies and mobilizes his concept of free will that he very briefly covered in chapter one, I think, where he was talking about human motivation, that sort of thing. But free will is basically... if you recall, it's a limited power of choice. It presupposes capacity for self-determination while preserving personal integrity and upholding personal ethical and legal responsibility for one's choices. So because of these various limitations, which, as you recall, constrict what people can do and when and where, now with the introduction of time and space, the exercise of free will requires a purpose, so chapter 10, which in turn provides a motivation or rationalization to engage in cooperative activities, so to contribute to the organization. So cooperation is then an expression of human will and purpose within some kind of a physical environment. And this chapter is basically about that. So bringing the individual back in and thinking of how limitations of both the body and the environment shape what people are willing to do, really. And I mean, in the next chapter, he will expand on this with his famous term, the zone of indifference. But this is where the foundations of that, I think, are. And this is, I think, the main contribution of this chapter, in addition to persuasion, in terms of building his argument. So there. Miranda, your turn now.
Oh! no, very convincing. I saw it more from the point of view of how to get people to be to cooperate, but I accept your view perfectly. I just want to point out one thing, which small detail, but something that I found very curious in this chapter, is how the critique of incentives seen as material things also breaches out on a more societal level. So if you go to page 144, it says, a concurrent result has been the creation of sentiments in individuals that they ought to want material things. The inculcation of proper ambitions in youth have greatly stressed material possessions as an evidence of good citizenship, social adequacy, and so on and so forth. And I found it quite curious how a theory on organizations manages to introduce a criticism towards society in general in the 1930s. So, I don't know, I found it very, very curious and I appreciated it a lot.
Yes. So it's not a critique of organizations, it's a critique of consumerism.
Consumerism.
Yes, absolutely.
Which by extension is critique of Frederick Taylor and Henry Ford.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I did not pay that much attention to it. Probably because I was preoccupied with my thing. So
well, that's the value of these conversations. You can learn new stuff.
Yes, but it also sort of exposes this idea that he has about what are the worthy incentives, and they have, for Barnard, little to do with stuff, basically. So, and if it has little to do with stuff, then one can dialectically conclude that he thinks development and incentives should have more to do with self-development and sort of spiritual growth.
Right, right. Well, he talks a couple pages later on at the bottom 158, leading to 159. He says, the scheme of incentives is probably the most unstable element of the cooperative system, since external conditions that affect material incentives are subject to change, right? I mean, so you could read all sorts of stuff into that about basically, you know, buy material things and other people are getting them and you want to, you know, it changes what you want to buy and stuff. So he says it's risky if you found your cooperative system, you know, strictly on material incentives because it's so unstable. That's really powerful.
And another thing he says there at the beginning of 159, that incentives actually represent power balance within the organization. So the actual sentence is a bit more a bit more difficult to decrypt, but it goes as follows. Thus, incentives represent the final residual of all the conflicting forces involved in organization, a very slight change in underlying forces often making a great change in the power of incentives. And yet it is only by the incentives that the effective balancing of these forces is to be secured, if it can be secured at all. So quite a profound insight into bribing your employees, really. That if you, I mean, maybe I'm reading too far into it, but having different units presupposes a distribution of power, of course, and authority, and he talks about this in later chapter, next chapter, actually. But he acknowledges that different managers, middle and line and otherwise, may use different types of incentives to motivate their employees, and that this can be a result of, this can result in power imbalance, and changing incentives may upset that further. So this was, I kind of wish he elaborated more on that, but I also understand how it's tricky. I was trying to think of an example of something like this, but I sort of ran out of time. Do you have any...
Are you talking about power imbalance?
About how incentives can upset that.
Oh, absolutely. So what you see in an Navy ships, so I'll give you a Navy ship example, and then maybe I can also give you one from traveling in New Zealand just last week. So the Navy example is you have different organizations or of the subunits or phases of cooperation on the ship have different functions at different times. And so there are some parts of organizations on the ship that don't have a lot to do. They really can't practice their primary job unless the ship is underway and operating. So when they're in port, there's not much for them to do. And therefore, their workday is often can often be like 3 or 4 hours a day, and then they just they can get sent home by their leadership because there's not much for them to do. And then you have organizations like the ones I've been in engineering. The workload can actually go up in port because you've got maintenance and training and certain kinds of work you can't do when the ship is underway, and it would be it would often become a morale problem because the guys in my unit would see the people from the other unit going home every day at 11 o'clock, walking down the pier, and they were done for the day. And so that caused some divisiveness and complaining. And I had to explain to them, well, we have a different mission and we're doing different stuff and their job is different than yours. And you can't just make them stay. It's not just about who stays to however, what time of day. It's also based on the work you have to get done. But that was a cause of some dissatisfaction and concern amongst the people I was working with. Does that make sense?
It does. I think so.
Yes, it does.
All right. And then go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to ask whether there was any change in this situation that maybe altered something.
Yes. I mean, I couldn't change the work that the people I was working with had to do. That I couldn't fix. But you could go to the officers in charge of the other unit and say, okay, you got to hold these guys a little bit longer because going home every day actually was kind of a violation of the commanding officer's policies. He didn't want people going home like that. So you didn't want to tell the commanding officer these guys were doing that. But, you'd go to those officers and say, hey, look, that's causing a problem. You're going to have to make them stay a little bit longer past lunch. When my guys aren't able to see them, leaving the ship every day. I understand the nature of the work is different. But, you would have a talk to them and say, well, you're causing a morale problem doing this. And I don't think they were aware of it because they were just kind of focusing on their purpose in the organization and what they had to get done. But the other example I can think of was in New Zealand. There's a store called Pack and Save in New Zealand. I actually never went into it, but it's a grocery store of some kind. And people in the South Island in the Christchurch area were picketing and complaining, and it was some kind of one-day strike or protesting. I don't know exactly what they were doing because they said that people, they were, and all I know is what I saw from the news, but I thought it was a very interesting application of Bernard. They said people in the North Island, which has a bit of a different economy, different population, many differences, perhaps different cost of living in some of the cities up there, they were getting paid up to $2 New Zealand an hour more for the same kind of work than the people in the South Island. And what I was just thinking was you would never see a complaint quite like that in the United States because it is nobody thinks everybody should make the same amount of money in different regions in the United States because the cost of living. I shouldn't say that. Few people do because the cost of living are different. But here these people were saying, hey, these people are getting paid a different amount in a different city with different expenses than we are, but we want to be paid the same. And they considered it that they weren't being a lack of equity. So I thought that was very interesting. That was something that's considered worth protesting, getting television coverage for, and so forth.
It's a little bit like the London allowance, that if you work in London, you get like £3,000 a year more just because you live there.
Yeah, yeah. We have the same thing in the States, and people don't generally question it. I wouldn't say not everybody, you know, but it's basically kind of accepted that these things, you have these things like the London allowance. We call them... it's called different things in different places, but it's generally assumed that if you live in an urban area where the expenses are high, you will get paid more just for that reason. And we're saying, look, we're not saying you're worth more, but it's more expensive to find a place to live there.
All right. So moving on to chapter 12 on authority, which kind of builds on chapter 11. And he has a very interesting view on authority. So for Barnard, authority is essentially a combination of this willingness of individuals to contribute to the organization that we talked about just now, and communication. So authority for Barnard is the character of a communication within the organization by virtue of which communication is accepted by a face of cooperation, i.e. person, to member of the organization as governing the actions that people should do. In English, this means that authority is basically accepting directives from others as legitimate in a situation where you're willing to cooperate.
Yeah, I think that's profound. That because I couldn't have done a historical analysis of the term authority, which may be worthwhile, but this idea that it actually depends on the willingness of the person, you know, the individual, to obey. You know, that he makes that decision, that is just amazing, because I think we have this, it's probably still very strong in common language usage. You know, authority means I can just dictate to you. It's all about dictation, right? I just tell you what to do. And this whole, there's basically no thought about this, well, I get to decide whether or not I want to do it. I mean, there is some modern writing along those lines, but whenever I try to explain that point to people, that I can issue all the orders I want, but I'm not the guy in charge of deciding whether to do it or not. People, they kind of wrinkle up their brow a bit, and because it's not something that a lot of people think about. I think that's amazing that he came right out and said that.
Right, and there's another aspect to it that. It is a function of a very specific type of communication, which is basically formal. So he talks about ritual and about how ritual is being important. And it builds on Weber quite a lot. So, for example, on page 172, in the middle of section 1, he says, hence the importance ascribed to the time, place, dress, ceremony, and authentication of a communication to establish its official character. So there is a lengthy masquerade of different things that need to be at play in order for any communication to be considered as official and hence authoritative. So the two things there are that, one, all official communication is authoritative because, as with Weber, you have a rational legal hierarchy. So directives coming from one office to another carry with it some kind of authority, really. So if a higher office tells you to do something that is within their field of responsibility, then you ought to be doing that, and same applies to people below. But he also mentions things like proper attire and even stuff like letterheads. You know, you get a very official looking letter, it's already carrying with it a significant amount of weight, even if the content is not necessarily serious or even relevant. Just getting artifacts that represent the organization that everyone is willing to contribute to is enough in its own right to impregnate the communication with some kind of authority and to legitimize it. And that was really, really interesting.
Yeah, and so let's expand on that a bit, because I think this, in modern parlance, we don't notice it as much as perhaps they did back in his day. But I will tell you, in the U.S. Navy, and there's probably other organizations that are like this, the authorization to use letterhead, put something on a letterhead, an organization's, or we would say in the Navy, a command, the command's letterhead, is a big deal. That is generally the only person that, you know, doesn't need anybody's permission to do that is the commanding officer of the organization or the CEO. And after him, it's actually formally parceled out in instructions that say, here's the things, you know, these different people can do because it, for, you know, defined functions and that sort of thing. But I remember, and it still is today, it's that is very emphasized because of this formality, like you said, and the legitimization that is behind the use of letterhead. That's a very formal process in many organizations. And as you said, it conveys a sense of seriousness, but also the legitimization of the communication. And I think now, you know, it's in this chapter, you start to see all the pieces that Bernard was setting up about, you know, communication system and an authoritative, you know, communications. Now you see them starting to come together, and you see why he was building all these things separately. So one of the things I really liked about this chapter is many of these pieces are coming together in a coherent way in the theory that he puts together.
So I just wanted to go to page 165 just to recall the four conditions which have to exist when an individual will accept a communication as authoritative. So the first one is goes back to understanding the communication, which is quite interesting, this concept of understanding, that sometimes it's a good thing and sometimes it isn't. Then the idea of the communication being consistent with the purpose of the organization and compatible with the personal interest of the person, of the individual, and the individual has to be able to carry out this order or communication, whatever is the content.
Right, and all of these have to apply at the same time. That's another thing.
Because these four concepts, they kind of like trace back a lot of things that have been mentioned in the previous chapters. So I'm still quite skeptical about this concept of understanding, that sometimes it's positive, sometimes it's negative, sometimes we want it, sometimes we don't. Then there's this idea of the purpose of the organization. So I think whatever the individual's understanding of the purpose of the organization, even if it's not complete, he shouldn't note any specific contrasts with what he or she thinks the understanding, the purpose of the organization is. Then there's this idea of mental and physical ability. And then we also have personal interest. So, and this probably goes back to the reason why the individual has chosen to be part of the organization.
Right. I think understanding here is not used in the same way as we discussed previously.
It can't. Yeah, it can't be, can it?
I think he's falling prey of his terminology. So I think here it just means that you comprehend what is being said.
Yeah.
Right. Well, think about that. So I agree with you. And think about that though for a second. He's saying, you know, that if it doesn't matter what the leader wants, if you can't convey it in an understandable way to people, people are not going to see it as authoritative. I mean, that's fascinating. It to me, this reminds me of the management consultant whose name is escaping me, who used to say, was famous for saying, communication is what happens in the brain of the receiver, right? Doesn't matter what you say, it's how this person processes it. And so Bernard is talking about those forces at play. I think that's, so the other consultant kind of, he just summed it all up that way. And the name, as I said, the name starts with a D, and I'm not, Drucker. Drucker said that. So anyway, Drucker just kind of simplified it, and here Bernard is going into the details, and it's also, he's showing how it fits in the pieces of the cooperative system. So I think, Miranda, I think you did a great job of kind of summing up those pieces. One part I want to talk about, though, is this idea, like the mental and physical ability to comply with the order, and because he goes on a little later on page 166, and he says, a little impossible is still impossible. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, that's funny, isn't it?
Because he was talking about that whole thing. You know, we had this notion today of stretch goals and big, hairy, audacious goals. You know, those kind of things that Jim Collins writes about. And I just love that. A little impossible is still impossible.
But in this context, he still says something that very much attributes a lot of agency to the individual. So he says, if a person is unable to comply with an order, obviously it must be disobeyed, or better, disregarded. So if a person cannot execute the order, take this really heavy block of stone from A to B, but you're like not strong enough, then you don't even have to disobey. You just disregard it as irrelevant, as a non-order.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not... So
that's great.
That's a profound point. It's not disobeying. You're just ignoring it because you can't do it. I mean, that's one of the things I think as a leader you have to be very cautious of is, you want to get people... because he has that... I wish you'd expand a little bit more on it, but it's that very nice section around the part about a little impossible. It's like, you want to have people goals that are a little bit beyond what they might be able to go do, but they still have to be feasible. You know, and like you said, Demetrius, you can't give somebody a goal that says, go carry this block of stone that's, you know, four times your weight with tweezers, you know, across the room. And I think, so not only can it be, you know, disregarded, I think the one of the things that Bernard is saying is that it's perfectly within the right of the employees not to follow it. So you're actually damaging or diminishing your authority. What an amazing way to look at that.
Immediately after this section, he elaborates and says that something to the effect of basically it is not a function of the executive to issue stupid orders.
Yeah.
Because they are not orders per se. That order, command, directive has to comply with these four characteristics that Miranda mentioned. And it's something like along the lines of this saying that you ask a silly question, you get a silly answer. Here is that you give a silly order and people ignore you.
Yes. In fact, we have an expression I learned in the Navy, but maybe it's used elsewhere, where you get leaders asking you to do silly things, and that comes up all the time. And the short version of that is, you want it bad, you get it bad. Right, so you want something really badly, right? And in other words, it's not like you're
saying
that's
very good.
Yeah, it's great. You know, you want this really badly, and it's like this really important thing. Well, if all of these pieces don't get up, you're going to get something bad. It's not what you wanted. And so I thought that, because you're always getting people say, "Yeah, we want this 400-page report overnight." Okay, that's so I can produce something, but it's not going to be very. It's not going to be what you want. So yeah, so that's sort of a nice aphorism that sums up Bernard, but Bernard, you know, it's a very nice way of showing how all those pieces fit together. I thought that was just profound.
This is an excellent chapter. And I want to talk a little bit about the second point, the one that at the time of his decision, the employee, male or female, believes that it is not inconsistent with the purpose of the organization. And I think there may be some confusion there. So I want to emphasize that this has to do with conflict of orders more than anything else. So the purpose of the organization here may be referring more to the chain of command than this higher purpose thing that we discussed in the context of understanding. And
I think you're right about that, but I think it can be both ways. So I think based on the context in which he was writing, it probably does relate more to the conflict of orders, and he talks about that in the chapter. And I think you can also say, generally, though, when he talks about cooperation and what sustains incentives and those sorts of things, there does need to be a consistent with the overall purpose of the organization. So I think both could be true.
Right. Another key concept in this chapter is the famous zone of indifference.
I was hoping you were going to get to that.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
that's the crown jewel of the theory of authority.
So, absolutely.
Do you want to summarize? You seem enthusiastic.
I am very enthusiastic, and so he has, you know, it's not real long. I mean, it's, I don't remember being pages, and so it's a few paragraphs, but he talks about this zone of indifference that exists in each individual.
It's page 168.
Within which orders are, yeah. Okay. Thank you. So page 168, where orders are acceptable without conscious questioning of their authority. Right. So there's this idea that not every decision, you know, do you have to agonize over and decide, does it meet all those four requirements and stuff, that many things that just kind of fall in that zone of indifference. And I think it's nice because there's sort of a cognitive frugality aspect to it, right? Where you don't have to be doing this analysis of everything you issue, and that a lot of people it depends on where their bar is set, right? Because everybody's zone of indifference, I would imagine, is different. But I thought that was fascinating because you could read the four requirements that Miranda so nicely summarized in order to be authoritative and just say, gosh, you spent all day coming up with orders this way. And then he kind of gives you an out and says, well, yeah, but it's not a lot of stuff people can just kind of accept very easily because it's they're not going to constantly question it.
He gives an
how'd I do?
Very good. So he gives an example of, for instance, if a person enlists into the military and the military deploys abroad a lot, then it will not be a matter of debate if the person gets sent to, overseas somewhere, because this is something that is assumed and kind of signed on to at the moment of joining the organization. So that is kind of a zone of indifference. And depending on, this is very interesting how he puts this equation, that depending on how much trouble it is, as opposed to how much satisfaction and benefit an employee would get out of following the order, so depending on those two things, the zone of indifference will be either wider or narrower. So if you're asked to do something troublesome, but you don't get much out of it, you will disobey the order, or at least question that. If what you're supposed to be doing is not that difficult at all, but you get paid lots in material or non-material benefits, then sure, no problem. And if it's sort of balanced, then probably yes, but kind of depending on how much trouble it is going to be for the employee. So this is broadly how he balances this and defines the zone of indifference.
Yeah, and that's a great insight that it's not constant. It's dynamic and depends on the nature of the task and some of the other factors that you elucidated. And I think that's also very interesting, this idea that it's not just, we think of zones as being, more or less fixed a lot of times when we talk about them, but here's something that it's actually flexible.
It is a very fuzzy zone, but the morale for managers here is that there will be very few orders that fall within the zone of indifference. So bossing around for no reason is not going to work out because people will challenge those orders. And the zone of indifference, where people will not challenge what you asked of them to do, is not going to be that great generally in most of the organizations. So this is an insight that eluded Taylor and Fayol, who firmly believed in a top-down line of control and command, is that most of the things you will ask your employees to do will be challenged, or you will at least need to provide justification for why they should do that. And that's just fantastic.
Yeah, I think that's it's sort of the source of legitimacy that you don't really think a lot about when you come into organizations, but that's very important to understand if a communication is authoritative.
And that concludes part 1 of 4 of episode 8 on Chester Bernard. Listen to the following recording for the conclusion of this discussion.